right, thanks. Okay, thank you. I want to present some of the work we've been doing on a very old line of research that was first begun probably over 50 years ago, and I'll show you some of the literature behind that. This is work that was done by my student, Cammie Willett, but she couldn't be here today, so I'm presenting on her behalf. The benzoxazonoid compounds, which most people, if you have not studied natural products or phytochemistry, probably aren't familiar with, and I certainly wasn't until just a few years ago, but they've been studied for a long time because of their broad reactivity and their importance in the Poaceae family, which includes corn and wheat and rye, among other important agronomic crops. The reason for the interest was the allelopathic behavior of these compounds. They're known to be inhibitors of bacteria, plants, and fungi. But also, there was interest starting more than 50 years ago in looking at the degradation of triazines and the ability of BX compounds to impart triazine resistance in plants. So two reaction mechanisms have been proposed in the literature, but really this reaction between a chlorotriazine and the BX compounds had not really been fully characterized. So down here is just a generalized structure of these compounds with the different R's, and so you can get a number of different kinds of combinations of these BX compounds. What got us initially interested was some work that we published in 2011. This was a study in which we looked at the effect of different forages or vegetative covers on atrazine degradation. What we did is grow these plants to maturity, then isolated the rhizosphere soil. And what we found was that eastern gamma grass over here only had 10% of the atrazine left after 100 days. So we knew these compounds in eastern gamma grass rhizosphere were being exuded into the soil environment. And we wanted to follow up on that, and we found some literature indicating that they may have some of these phytochemicals in them. But once we started digging in that literature, there were really no peer-reviewed publications on the presence of BX compounds in eastern gamma grass. And so in 2013, we were the first to identify these compounds, and these were isolated from the roots because that was our interest, was to look at these compounds as potential root exudates. So we isolated two major ones, diboglucoside, which will be the main point of the talk here today. This has this hydroxamic acid moiety, which is key to the reactivity, and it can degrade atrazine, and we had confirmed that in these experiments after we isolated it. And then the HBO-glucoside, which is the lactam, having only a hydrogen here on the nitrogen, is non-reactive. But once we got to that point and we'd identified it, one of the issues was you cannot get a standard of this material. You can't just buy it. There's no common synthesis methods other than ones that are highly specialized that produce very small amounts of material. So the next step was to develop a method, and we developed a very simple method using semi-prep and HPLC, which worked much better than we would have ever expected, where we could take this crude extract, get this fraction here that's highlighted in gray, and in a single step get a purified material that was greater than 99% pure based on a variety of analyses, including NMR. So that gave us the standardized or standard authentic material to work from to be able to do the chemical characterization work. In 1961, Castelfranco was the first to propose a mechanism for the reaction of a chlorotriazine, in this example atrazine, with a hypothetical BX compound having that hydroxamic acid moiety. He hypothesized the formation of a conjugate here that would occur at the C2 position on the triazine ring via the oxygen and the hydroxamic acid moiety, release of chloride. But here, interestingly, he shows the reformation or regeneration of the hydroxamic acid, so it was viewed as catalytic. And this was simply because the technology they had at that time, they did not see the degradation of the BX compound that they were studying, so they assumed that it was being conserved and regenerated, and therefore catalysis was their speculation. And that's really persisted to the present day, the notion that these compounds are catalytic. The one thing that isn't controversial is that you get a hydroxytriazine out of it. The other approach reaction is the opposite, almost an electrophilic attack mechanism. This was proposed by Raveton et al. In 1997. It was really the last group to really seriously look at the reaction. They had some inclination that the reaction was first-order kinetics and therefore was concentration-dependent and was being consumed. So they came up with this hypothesis that under acidic conditions, you can protonate that hydroxamic acid, spin off some water, create this electrophile that can react with the chlorine on the 2 position, again form hydroxyatrazine, which they did observe, but they hypothesized this chlorinated BX compound. We had a couple problems with this. One, there's no known pKa for something that could protonate this. These are weak acids. pKa is about 7.6. There's not another lower pKa that we know of that would suggest that you could protonate it. The other is this chlorinated compound should be pretty easy to detect or confirm by modern mass spectrometry, and it never has been. So those were the two model reaction mechanisms that we had to work with in the literature. And what we wanted to do was fill in those gaps, and just basically our objective was to characterize this reaction of atrazine plus diboglucoside going to hydroxyatrazine, which is one thing we did know about it, possible formation of chloride, and then try to identify the BX compounds. So in characterizing it, we looked at establishing the kinetics and the stoichiometry of the reactions, looked at the pH effect, attempted to determine whether chloride does form, and then identify and confirm the structure of that intermediate that was hypothesized 53 years ago, and then identify the actual BX product that's spinning off of the diboglucoside. So I don't have a lot of time to go into massive details here, but what we basically did with the kinetic experiments is that we did excess, in the case of atrazine degradation, we put it in the presence of excess diboglucoside. We used C14. Atrazine, so we could follow the reaction with flow scintillation analysis in HPLC. So we have great sensitivity using that method, and we followed the reaction over 160 hours with multiple injections. We did a similar thing with the diboglucoside degradation kinetics, in which we had excess atrazine relative to diboglucoside. Here you have a little bit more constraints, though, in that we needed enough diboglucoside we could detect it and potentially the product coming off, but the solubility of also the solubility of atrazine. So it was only about a 2-to-1 ratio here. here we used HPLC UV and again followed this over 512 hours because the kinetics were somewhat slower. In both of these experiments, we did these in solution. These were 10-mil reaction vessels that had septa on them, and we could just inject them, put them on an autosampler, the LC, and then just eject at basically programmed times, and therefore only take out a negligible amount of solution in order to analyze these things during the course of the reaction. The intermediate formation, we used initially the HPLC flow scintillation analyzer to identify a radioactive compound that didn't match with either the parent or any known metabolites. We did identify that. Then we redid this reaction from this experiment here with cold material so that we could use the ultra-performance ultra-performance liquid chromatography tandem mass. So it's very high pressure now is what we've moved to is the water systems, and there's some other ones out there where they're running 12 to 14,000 PSI and you have very high throughput, but you're still using an electrospray interface. So much like the previous speaker was talking in terms of separating the molecules and then running the tandem mass. Chloride formation is amazing to me that as simple as IC is to do, that no one had ever tried this before. That's what we used. And then the BX product formation, we also used the UPLC tandem mass with a photodiode array. So reaction kinetics, what we saw was first order kinetics, just classic kinetics here, disappearance of atrazine and formation of hydroxyatrazine. This was 100-to-1 excess diboglucoside to atrazine in this experiment, and that gave us a half-life of atrazine of 20 hours. We saw 1-to-1 stoichiometry, 1 mole of atrazine degrading to 1 mole of hydroxyatrazine. The diboglucoside also showed classic first-order kinetics, so it was definitely being consumed, no doubt about it. We started at 50 micromoles. By the end of 512 hours, we were down to about 6 micromolar concentrations. Half-life there was 135 hours. This was a pH data, and we had read in the literature a little bit about the fact that this reaction tended to occur at a faster rate at low pH, but that really didn't make a lot of sense to us. But we did this experiment from pH 4 to 9, and even though the data is a little bit variable, you can see that we had significantly higher reactivity at pH 4 than we did from pH 6 on. And this really didn't make sense to us. Because if you look at these different forms of the hydroxamic acid, under low pH you have this resonance stabilized forms, but as you go higher pH you should deprotonate that. pKa is 7.6, so somewhere around pH 7 and above we should be dealing with the strongest nucleophile here, the negative charge. But that was definitely not the case, as our data showed and other data in the literature had shown. And in fact, Nakono et al. 73 proposed this mechanism in which the neutral form of the hydroxamic acid can protonate the chlorotriazine under acidic conditions. You're now getting within about 2 log units of the pKa of the chlorotriazine, so it can accept that proton, it can become charged, and now you're forming the stronger nucleophile. And that indeed seems to be what happens, is that we get that initial protonation reaction sets up the nucleophilic attack. The intermediate identification, We did see an intermediate. I think it had a retention time of about 28 minutes. It clearly did not correspond to anything that we knew would come off, like hydroxyatrazine or the parent or even any other known atrazine metabolites. Its concentration peaked in about 4 hours, and then it showed kind of a first-order loss and then was pretty much steady state, but was always present throughout that experiment. So then we did the cold version of that same experiment. We isolated a compound that had a pseudomolecular ion of 523, which had this structure that we're proposing here. These fragments at 361 and 343 both derived from the diboglucoside, so this part of the molecule. And the 198 is hydroxyatrazine, so we feel we definitely nailed that structure down. And then obviously this shows a pretty clear indication that it's one-to-one stoichiometry. It's not like we have two trizines and one diboglucoside or vice versa here, and it's definitely a one-to-one reaction. Chloride formation indeed was also stoichiometric. 20 micromolars of atrazine formed roughly 20 micromolar chloride. IC isn't quite as precise down at those concentrations, so we did have some noise in the data, but essentially a one-to-one, and indeed showed that the chlorinated mechanism couldn't be possible because we are releasing free chloride, as speculated 53 years ago. The BX product formation is the one place where we got tripped up. We identified this compound here, BOA, which is a benzoxazolinone, which is a good little tongue twister. And really, we realized that this did not inform us about the mechanism. It was really not the initial product coming off of the diboglucoside. And in fact, for this to form, we must have had some microbial degradation. We used sodium azide to preserve the samples, but it was not sufficient. And we clearly had some microbial degradation because we lost the glucose, which we couldn't have otherwise in this solution. It was not rigorous enough conditions, nor would we have had any enzymes in the solution. So we feel we must have had microbial contamination. You formed diBOA, and this is known to spontaneously form the BOA. So that was the one place we got tripped up, was that after 512 hours of the incubation for the diBOA glucoside experiment, combined with the fact that it was another month before we actually did the tandem mass work, those samples must have been compromised. But we did learn enough to be able to propose a new mechanism. We clearly have a nucleophilic attack going on here between the hydroxamic acid moiety and the C2 position here on the triazine ring. We know that the intermediate conjugate forms and that this oxygen ultimately is placed over here on hydroxyatrazine. We know chloride's forming. And so for us, the logical thing would be to protonate that nitrogen and form the lactam, which would not react or non-reactive. But obviously we need to go back, and that's the one piece of the puzzle that's left to confirm. So we're going to redo that experiment and then just follow it with the LC-TANA mass over a shorter period of time to show the formation of the HBOA glucoside. So then in conclusion, first-order kinetics classically for both the reactants and the product formation in the case of hydroxyatrazine. We clearly refuted both of the existing mechanisms out there. It's neither catalytic nor was there a chlorinated BX compound formed. We definitively showed the one-to-one structure or a one-to-one stoichiometry, identified that conjugate structure, and then proposed this nucleophilic, non-catalytic nucleophilic attack with the lactam formation. Just an acknowledgement of my funding support, and with that, if there's time, I'd answer questions.